Welcome to Season 2, Episode 8 of the People First Economy Podcast, a podcast where we talk with business leaders and movement builders who are building a people first economy. I'm your host, Emmanuel Ibera, and we're bringing you this episode of the People First Economy Podcast in part of our Gift Local, Gift Good campaign, a campaign we put together to be a resource to our members and our audiences to help them shop locally and shop sustainably during this holiday season. So for this campaign, we wanted to host a conversation that sheds light on some of the reasons why shopping local is not only good for the economy, but for the planet. So when we came across the recent report put out by the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, highlighting the practices that well-financed companies that are usually backed by Wall Street have used to gain footing to dominate markets while hollowing out communities and threatening the viability of our locally rooted economies in the process. And we thought, oh, this is the perfect topic to highlight on the podcast. So, joining me on the podcast today is a very special guest in Ron Knox, a senior researcher at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and writer for their Independent Business Initiative. The Institute for Local Self-Reliance is a national research and advocacy organization that partners with allies across the country, like People First Economy, to build an American economy driven by local priorities and accountable to people and the planet. So without further ado, Ron Knox. Welcome to the People First Economy Podcast.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Can you further introduce yourself and just tell us a little bit more about your role at ILSR?
Sure. So, as you mentioned, I'm a senior researcher. But all that means is that I investigate different aspects of our increasingly monopolized and concentrated economy. And I try to devise ways to improve public policy in ways that serve to deconcentrate those industries and to create more diverse and locally controlled communities. And I then take all that information that I gather during my researching process and I write about it. Sometimes I write internally for our own reports, like the one I'm going to talk about today called Boxed Out. And other times I write for the popular press. I often write for the Washington Post and the Atlantic and, places like that.
Have you always been with ILSR? Like what is your background?
My background is as a journalist. That's what I went to school for at the University of Kansas, a world-renowned research institute. And I got my start in journalism as a reporter. I worked for newspapers. Gotcha. And worked for wire services, and then eventually came to specialize in researching and writing about antitrust law and issues around monopoly power. And that's what I've done for the last 12 years or so. And I've been at ILSR since January 2020, so two and a half years or so.
Yeah. Okay, nice. And you're settling in? It's going well?
I'm settled. I feel pretty well settled in at this point. I love the work. I love being an advocate for, a deconcentrated and, democratic and equitable economy and society. So it's great work and I love doing it.
So before we jump right into talking about this report, Ron, could you define for us just quickly antitrust? Just to make sure that we're all on the same page, I realized when I was like reading, I was like, okay, I need to be sure about like what antitrust is, slash in the podcast, I should ask this guy, like what, if he can define it.
I'm going to try to define antitrust law in the best way I can. I don't have the definition in front of me. So you got to forgive me. But here's what I think it is. Antitrust law is intended to prevent the kinds of business practices that can undermine competition between businesses, hurt workers, hollow out communities, and hurt regular everyday shoppers for various things of all stripes, whether the thing that you're that you have to buy is food at the supermarket, whether the thing you have to buy is electricity from your power company. Like, antitrust law is intended to prevent all of those things in support of again, opportunity, democracy, and fairness in the economy.
Yeah. So let's talk about Boxed Out. What can you tell us about the support? Like, what is it about?
So, I mean, I think the motivation, you know, for right, I'll start with the motivation, and then I'll get to what the report's about. The motivation behind the report, I think, really came from a lot of inequities that surfaced and became really apparent during the pandemic, right? Where there were reports all over the economy of, supply chain issues, all this fragility that we've built into the economy, oftentimes through this extreme levels of corporate concentration that we see everywhere. And the result of that was that big, powerful stores and sellers and chains, and then Amazon on the online side, they had easy, free access to basically anything they wanted in the economy. Anything that they like needed to put on their shelves, they could put on their shelves. Whereas smaller sellers, independent stores, mom and pop shops, places that you would find on Main Street, or even smaller sellers online, were struggling mightily to acquire the same stuff that their customers just simply expected them to have, and then would turn up at their stores and be deeply disappointed that they didn't have them, and they would end up turning to the Walmarts, to the Krogers, and to the Amazons of the world. So that was kind of the state of affairs. And we at the Institute had this understanding of the history of these kinds of situations, and at least in part the drivers of this kind of inequality that you would see across the economy between the big stores and the smaller stores. And so we decided to write a report essentially reflecting on the impacts of the pandemic, but then saying, look, this is not new. These kinds of inequalities that you see in the economy have been going on since basically the dawn of the chain store, right? Back in the 20s and 30s. And we actually have policies on the book. We have laws on the books that are intended in their spirit to push back on these inequalities and to create a more democratic marketplace, certainly on the retail side, but throughout the economy, and that these tools could be used, reshaped, redeployed today to fix some of these vast disparities in supply and access and so on. That really cropped up during the pandemic. So that's really what the report is about. It's called Boxed Out because we're talking about the power of big box stores, but also, of course, of Amazon, now as this massive hulking retail, giant. So that was the impetus to do this report, and it details, the history and the policies behind everything I just talked about.
Yeah, is the title also a reference to I think is the basketball term of like boxing, box people out?
Well, thank you. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly right. So for those who don't play the game, there's a core kind of element of basketball that if you're going up for a rebound and you're trying to get the ball from your opponent, you box them out. That is, you try to put them on your back, you try to take the space away from your opponent.
Yeah. And you push them aside.
Exactly. So that's where the title comes from. But,
gotcha.
But we're also obviously talking about the box stores
and, yeah.
And the big chain retailers being able to do that to small business.
Yeah, the way that it was outlined in the report, I finally put it together today. I was like, oh, boxed out. It's exactly what they're doing, just like in an economic sense of using the finances that they have to push out their competition, using their size to give themselves an advantage. And they use it to a degree that's super effective. But I guess it wasn't always that way.
Look, it's extreme. No, it wasn't always that way. I was going to say it's extremely effective when you don't enforce the law that's intended to stop that kind of behavior from happening. Yeah. But yeah, we do love a good sports analogy. And look, I'm happy that you mentioned, you know, the size, because in some ways that's really at kind of the core of what we're talking about in this report, that in a lot of ways, the kind of, you know, the core issue, the key to this bad corporate behavior, which I can explain more. I haven't even really talked about it, but the key to this behavior is the size of these companies and the sheer power that they're able to bring to bear in the marketplace and to take advantage of in ways that are intended to crush their smaller competitors, to extract all kinds of, you know, favorable terms and discounts and so on from their suppliers and all that. But it really all comes down to size and to the way that these big retailers use their size.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Robinson-Patman Act, because that was throughout the whole report, it was referenced a lot. Why was it passed in the first place? Like, what were some of those behaviors that big companies were engaging in that forced Congress to acknowledge and pass this act?
Sure. Well, it was passed in response to the rise of the big box stores of that age, which are really the first chain supermarkets and chain retailers that in the 1920s and 1930s really took over large parts of the retail economy across the country. And stores like A&P, stores like Kroger existed back then, just like it exists today, but it was one of the first real supermarket chains. And as these chain stores grew, they began to take advantage of their size by demanding from their suppliers, then as now, were a lot of, you know, farmers and, ranchers and...
Yeah, food producers, yeah.
Food producers, exactly. And they said, look, you need us. If you want your food supplies that you make, if you want them to reach customers, you got to go through us. You're going to give us a discount. Here's what we're going to pay. Here are the quantities that you're going to, deliver. Here are the sizes of packages, all these things. And whereas your smaller independent stores, which there are far fewer today for all of these reasons, but, you know, back in those days, it was your independent dry goods stores and your independent markets and green grocers and so on that really served a lot of communities around the country. And these smaller stores acting independently had no such bargaining power.
Yeah.
And indeed often had to pay more to make up for those discounts that the big chain stores were able to secure from these suppliers, because the suppliers had to make some money too. They had their own margins. So what ended up happening was that a lot of these independent stores started going out of business. They simply could not stay afloat. I mean, they couldn't, yeah. But it wasn't competition on the merits. It wasn't fairness. They literally just couldn't make money because they were having to pay so much more than the big chain stores were having to pay. So that's where you have this idea that there was this price discrimination, and it was often driven by the chain stores and then enacted by the suppliers. The suppliers were the ones who were having to essentially being forced to discriminate in this way. So Congress stepped in Well, the first thing that happened was the Federal Trade Commission did a big investigation. The Federal Trade Commission said, what's actually happening? They interviewed a ton of manufacturers all over the country. And the manufacturers largely said, yeah, we're being bullied. We're being pushed around by these big chain stores. We don't have a choice. You know, it's either we make up our margins from the small sellers or we go out of business, and we can't do that. So we are essentially, we're being pushed around too. And then in 1936, Congress decided to take action and they passed the Robinson-Patman Act. And the Robinson-Patman Act is essentially a bill attempting to ensure and preserve a democratic nation, both in the economic sense and indeed in the political sense. The Robinson-Patman Act says you cannot have this kind of discrimination because we value, as a nation, we value this idea that an economy has to be open and fair, and it has to provide opportunity for everybody along the chain, right? From the small stores, medium stores, big stores, small suppliers, big suppliers, everybody has to have a fair shake. And you can't have this kind of bullying happening in the marketplace. So that's what the Robinson-Patman Act says. It essentially bans this kind of price discrimination and some adjacent things to it, right? It bans suppliers from doing the discrimination. It also bans the retailers from forcing suppliers to discriminate between their various buyers, whether they're big and small and so on. And it also says, look, if it's the same grade and quantity, if it's the same size, you got to charge the same price for it, because that's fairness. And that's the way that everybody gets a fair shake in the marketplace. So for a lot of years, the Federal Trade Commission, which was the agency tasked with enforcing this law, did enforce it. They used it, in fact, quite vigorously. And what happened was that it created this mid-century economy in which small stores were able to survive and indeed thrive. Mid-sized stores, regional chains could survive, and the big stores could survive. And they could all serve their various communities in the way that was best that was best targeted at that specific community. So if it's a small town, maybe you just need some smaller stores. If it's a big city, you need a variety of things, because people shop in a variety of ways, and they could all thrive. So it ushered in this era of this vibrant and growing middle class, because you had people who could open up a store, who could run a small business in a small town, and they could succeed in that, and they could grow that business, and they could live this middle class life. You had workers in the big chains, where there was a huge amount of unionization that happened, that went hand in hand with good labor law. And so you had the workers in the big chain stores who were making a middle class life, and you had this vibrant economy in which there was a ton of fairness. And yeah. By the 70s, things started to fall apart, and there were some pretty vast sweeping policy changes.
Yeah. What sparked all that? In the report, you mentioned that there was just a new generation that just favored big business and a more laissez-faire approach to running the economy. Like, where did that come from?
Well, I mean, essentially, big business struck back. To use the kind of Star Wars analogy. I mean, yeah. Big business. Which is, was then and remains a special interest in Washington and elsewhere. They didn't like these restrictions on what they could do. So they pushed this idea, this concept that antitrust law, which the Robinson-Patman Act is an antitrust law, should not serve these public policy concerns of creating a democratic economy and preserving the rights of small business to compete and also preserving the rights of workers to earn a fair wage and do all these other things. They said antitrust law should be about consumer prices. And that's it. That's all it should be about. It wasn't even really about prices. I mean, it is and it isn't. But what it was really about was a wealth transfer. They said they said that the functioning of a business should be to create wealth and have this, what we, you know, what they call a wealth surplus. And it didn't matter where that surplus went. Maybe it went to consumer, maybe it went to shoppers, maybe, or maybe it went to CEOs and shareholders. Didn't matter to them. They just said that's what it should be. So starting in about the mid-1970s, there was this shift. There was this shift to believing that the consumer welfare standard was actually what mattered in antitrust law, and that the small businesses didn't matter. And indeed, that that was a corrupting factor in the enforcement of the antitrust laws. So along with a lot of other legal changes, enforcement of the Robinson-Patman Act completely fell by the wayside. And there were significant efforts to repeal the law altogether, because they treated it as some antique, some outdated concept that didn't need to be a part of our legal framework anymore. And the only thing that mattered was these ideas of corporate efficiencies. And they said that bigness is good. The bigness helps. It's more efficient than the small seller, and so the Robinson-Patman Act has not been enforced at all, not a single case in the last 20 years. And what we have now, as we saw very clearly during the pandemic, is an economy, particularly a retail economy, that is absolutely dominated by huge corporations that are completely disconnected from communities, and that bully their suppliers, push around small business without any kind of check on that behavior.
Yeah, after I read this report, I was reflecting on this whole thing. It's definitely felt like throughout my life, there's been a lack of a focus or an emphasis of the importance of our local economies and the role that small businesses play in our communities. It's always been like the small business is the backbone of our economy, and then that's it. And then moving on, when talking about the economy, it's always been about stock markets, or it's always talked about at a global or national scale and imports, exports, and whatever. That local piece was always missing from the conversation. It definitely shows in the way that we have built up our communities and the way that we're still building out our communities.
Yeah. So, it has real effects. I mean, this isn't some theoretical thing. You know what I mean? We're not pushing back against these all powerful retail giants just to do it, just because we're nostalgic about some old idea of what a Main Street's supposed to be. That's literally not it. You can see, I mean, it became as clear as you could want it to be during the pandemic that we have built an incredibly fragile economy where if we lose production somewhere, where if something falls offline, that the whole thing falls apart, and suddenly people, regular people, working people, can't get the stuff they need to survive. And small businesses can't even access the basic material, the basic stuff they need to stay afloat and to stay in business. How did we get here? We got here because we don't enforce the Robinson-Patman Act and other antitrust laws. It allows these huge sellers to, you know, the Walmarts, the Targets, the Amazons of the world to push around their suppliers, say, look, you're going to give us the stuff first. And if there's some left over, then maybe the small store down the street can get it. But if not, we don't care. Tough. You're going to give us better prices. And so what happens? So the small store down the street goes out of business because they can't compete because it's not fair, because they're not competing on a level playing field. You know, maybe, you know, the small seller down the street often actually serves its customers better. They're actually more responsive to the needs of the community. They actually pay more for their employees because, again, they're part of the fabric of the community. They can't, you know, pay minimum wage to their workers and get away with it. So they go out of business. All of that falls apart. And then maybe the suppliers that they kept on their shelves, that Walmart doesn't keep on its shelves, or Target doesn't keep on its shelves, those suppliers don't have anywhere to sell their goods anymore. So they go out of business. Yeah. And then the entire thing becomes more narrow, more concentrated, and vastly more fragile.
And we're more reliant on a few businesses rather than a whole skew of them.
Yeah, exactly. And so you end up with communities where, you know, there have been studies about this. A Walmart opens in the next town, and in the town nearby, the businesses go out because people drive 30 miles to the Walmart or whatever. The businesses go out. All of the ancillary businesses that serve those businesses, the accounting firms, the local cleaners, all that kind of stuff, they struggle. They go out, and you end up with these absolutely hollowed out communities. Because Walmart and companies like Walmart are able to exert their power in ways that that unfairly, and I think illegally, put their smaller rivals out of business simply through the sheer power that comes with its size and our unwillingness from a policy perspective, our unwillingness to enforce these laws that are on the books.
Yeah. And it leaves our communities, like you said early on, vulnerable to outside forces. Those businesses that contributed to our communities aren't able to stand on their own two legs. And so all the benefits that they give to a thriving, vibrant community, it just isn't possible anymore. And then our lives are revolving around these places like corporations that, you know, set up businesses that just extract our wealth and our joy to an extent, and limits our options, limits our worldview. It does a lot, and it buckles our culture.
In some ways, I mean, I think it really, you know, it really strips us of part of what it means to be a citizen, to be a community member. You know,
yeah.
When you have these hollowed out communities, and when all of the wealth of a community is being funneled out of that community and to some corporate headquarters that's far flung and has no interest in the community that it's now serving, civic life is left hollow, you know, because what, you know, when you have local businesses that are serving the community, everybody becomes tied to one another and our fates become aligned, right? As a community, our fates become aligned. You know, like my neighbor owns this business down the street. They want, you know, this business needs better roads. They need more lighting. They need, you know, tax policy. They need good schools for the kids. I mean, all these things, they're all tied together. And all of our fates become one. And when those businesses are gone, and all of this wealth and energy and so on is being sucked out of the community and taken somewhere else, that fabric tears, right? And it leaves us more susceptible to lack of, you know, oneness with your mm-hmm. neighbors mm-hmm. and with the person in the next town over, to all the things that we see throughout our society, right? The mistrust, the disinformation. When I talk about the Robinson Padman Act, it's like, oh, it's some law, whatever. This law was about literally democracy.
Yeah.
And it was about opportunity for everybody, because lawmakers in Congress at that time understood that if that opportunity was taken away, that if we were all simply made to be low-level workers for some big corporate thing, that it stripped us of the very thing that makes the democracy function. And that's our ability to participate and our ability to affect change in our own lives. And once that's taken away, we don't have much else. We're not left with much else. You know what I mean? So yeah. Anyway, yeah. That's kind of core to this argument that we make in the paper, that that the law is on the books for a reason. It was important then, it remains important now, and it should be enforced, and indeed perhaps it should be strengthened as well.
It's difficult to try to enforce it, though, because like you said, there is a lot of discrimination that goes unregulated. What is the path forward? You talked about amending the law and updating the laws. Like, what recommendations are you suggesting?
Well, look, I mean, I think the first and the clearest recommendation is just to enforce the law. It's on the books. It exists. Nobody's repealed it. It's, you know, it's still there, just like any other law. And enforcing it or not enforcing it is simply a policy choice at this point. So our main recommendation is to enforce the law. And we think that doing so does two things. One, this is all, you know, muscle memory, right? If you don't use these muscles, they atrophy, you forget what they're supposed to do, and so on. So simply using this law in the way that it was intended to address this kind of economic price discrimination and this predatory buying, as we call it, it strengthens that muscle, and it makes it so that we as a country and as a policy-based country can actually stop this kind of behavior and again rebuild that muscle memory so that we can do it again. The other thing it does that I think is just as important is it signals, look, this kind of discrimination is rampant throughout our economy. It happens, mm-hmm. It happens everywhere. There are news stories about it all the time, and we hear about it all the time from the small businesses that we talk to. What does not happen all the time is that this conduct actually gets reported to the FTC, which is the agency that's, again, in charge of enforcing this law. Why doesn't it get reported? Because they haven't brought a case in two decades. So bringing the case, enforcing the law, is a signal. It doesn't just rebuild that muscle memory, but it also is a signal to the small business community, to people out there in small towns and big cities and everywhere else who experience this kind of discrimination, that they can turn to the agency and say, hey, that you brought that one case, well, this is happening to me and this is happening in my community and you should bring this next case. So it starts to build up this idea that this law is real. It's, you know, it's enforceable, that the conduct that these big businesses are doing is illegal and it's wrong, and that they're going to take steps to, you know, to stop it. So again, our number one policy prescription is actually enforcing the law.
Yeah. I would be remiss if I didn't bring up Dollar General or dollar stores as just an example of how they go into communities and disrupt the local economies that exist there. Can you paint a picture of what these companies do when they attempt to enter into a community? And then if they do, you know, what does it look like for them to be there?
Sure. So, you know, dollar stores and, you know, and these dollar chains are really core to the arguments that we're making, because they're almost, their entire business model is built around this idea of, you know, price discrimination, that they have immense power as retailers. They extract all kinds of, you know, discounts of size differences, the size of the packaging and so on from these suppliers. And because these companies are so prevalent around the country, that they really have the power to bully suppliers and to shut smaller retailers out of the market. And look, this, you know, I'm happy that you bring up the dollar stores, because the tactics that they use are are particularly dangerous because they target some of the most vulnerable communities in America. And these are small towns that have often already been hollowed out because of this kind of industrial concentration, because of loss of manufacturing and so on, and Black and brown communities in urban areas that have suffered through generational disinvestment and all of the other terrible effects of institutional racism. And so, you know, these dollar stores that enter these communities and use these predatory tactics, right, this price discrimination, this predatory buying, to essentially put the existing local supermarket, local greengrocer, corner stores, and so on, completely out of business, because they again can basically import this predation, these kinds of predatory tactics, into any community in which they're allowed. So it's really a prime example of how destructive this kind of price discrimination can be, how necessary enforcement of the law is, and how these kind of tactics really prey on communities that are potentially less able to to fight back or to push back against these kind of tactics.
Yeah, so you mentioned the solution, one being at the policy level. I think the solution will have to incorporate entrepreneurship, supporting entrepreneurs and giving them an easier pathway forward to growing their business. There's a data point here in the report that goes, Walmart captures one of every $4 that Americans spend on groceries and controls more than half in 43 metropolitan areas. And I assume that if you add in Dollar Generals or Kroger's or any other big box stores, we need entrepreneurs to be part of that solution. Like, we need, if we want our economy to be rooted in our local communities, then we need members of those communities to step up and take a risk and start their own business. And we also need the community to support them in that endeavor. And because if we want to change this economy, if we want to change that statistic, it needs to happen. And it's a little frustrating reading that, though, because like it makes me feel like we're so far removed from all that. And it almost seems like, how can you start a business during in this kind of market? How can you compete with these large businesses?
Well, look, I mean, it is frustrating. I agree with you that it's frustrating. And I also agree with you that there needs to be, and we advocate strongly for all of these different kinds of supports for entrepreneurs and for folks who want to start new businesses and want to be able to succeed. And that support looks like access to capital. It looks like access to resources and available, commercial real estate, all these kinds of things. And we fight for all of this. But look, no one is going to be clamoring to start some small business that's going to have to compete head to head with Walmart or head to head with Amazon or these other stores on the existing uneven playing field that the economy is built on today. The only way that we're going to see an increase in entrepreneurship, the only way we're going to see Main Street commercial districts and small towns and big towns all over this country that aren't like Amazon proof, that aren't just a series of barbershops and and nail salons and so on, is if we enforce and strengthen our anti-monopoly laws, the laws that are intended to create a level playing field. And we make clear to would-be entrepreneurs, to the small business community, that it's a priority. We're not going to let these kind of predatory tactics happen anymore. And indeed, we're going to take steps to deconcentrate the economy and to recreate this economy in which the small business, the medium-sized business, the big business can all exist and serve their communities in the ways the communities want to be served. And they're going to be able to do it without this kind of thumb on the scale that, you know, the big business is allowed to use right now.
Well, what excites you about that world that we could potentially live in if we change the economy for the better?
I'm excited about this because I'm excited about democracy. Look, I mean, democracy is at some serious risk at the moment in America, and other places, right?
It is intertwined with our economy. Yeah,
it is. It's completely intertwined. I mean, look, I mean, it is what it is. We don't live in a command and control centralized economy. We don't. That's not what we're doing here. Okay. So if we're going to continue on with this market system, all right, and that's, I think, what everybody intends to do, then it has to be fair and it has to be open and it has to be democratic, because that's what these institutions are built on. That's what our communities are built on.
Yeah.
And when, again, you know, Congress knew this back in 1936, and I believe they probably know it in their hearts today, that when these systems that we've built up within the market economy fail, when they fail because competition has failed, because we've let markets become monopolized and become overly concentrated, then we all suffer, and democracy suffers, because we feel like we have nothing at stake. We've got nothing invested in this stuff. And that our system has utterly failed the vast majority of people, because we don't have these opportunities anymore, and we don't have the ability to create a middle class life for ourselves anymore. So my hope, you know, my vision is that we can take action before it's too late, and we can save this. And I think that ultimately starts at the policy level. And it starts with you know, recreating and preserving this idea of fairness.
Yeah, I'll tell you what excites me: seeing people create the communities that they want to be a part of. I'm a small business owner myself, and just opening the store that I've opened over this past years, it's been really fun seeing people coming through the door and supporting our mission. I opened a secondhand retail store in the heart of downtown Grand Rapids. Well, not the heart of, but, you know, on the edge. Anyways, it's been really cool seeing the support and seeing other entrepreneurs look at us and think like, okay, I can do that too. And since we've opened, 3 or 4 other new businesses have opened on our street. And it's exciting. There's excitement here in this little corner of Grand Rapids where we're at. And if that can continue, if we could get more people, you know, engaged and excited about, you know, building something up for themselves, contributing to the community in that way, I am just so excited to see what people can do, like what interesting stuff that they can make. And honestly, particularly food. God, I love good food, man. It's good stuff.
I hear all that. I really, really do. And congratulations on the business. And we support that 100%. And the thing that I get excited about is seeing entrepreneurs starting new businesses and seeing these once vibrant commercial centers, again, small towns, large cities everywhere, become reinvigorated and become used again. The thing that I get excited about is what does that look like in 20 years? You know what I mean? Yeah. Because that's when you really start to kind of cement in this idea of, you know, community and tradition. I want there to be some 18-year-old that walks into your secondhand store and says, man, my parents used to bring me here when I was just a little kid, or my grandparents used to bring me here when I was just a little kid. And now I'm still here. Now I'm going to go do my own shopping. I'm going to go and get my own vintage stuff. You know, like that's cool to me. That's the kind of continuity that we look for. That's the kind of community building that I want to see, because that's when it's at that point, I think, really. I mean, you know, it happens all throughout the years, right? But at that generational moment when the community has that, like, it's rebuilt that fabric, and it's like there's a kind of collective ownership feeling in the places that serve us in our communities, and that's the thing that ties us together, and that's the thing that rebuilds democracy to me.
I agree, and honestly, I feel like in that world I would feel a little bit more mentally stable, you know, with the climate of everything and our culture, like people just not being so much on edge. I don't know. I feel like definitely the way our economy is built plays into that. It's not good. Not good.
I mean, that's right. And when you see your neighbor, when you have your friends who are like, they started a business, they're doing fine. I know them. They're my friend. They're my, you know, whatever, they're my cousin, they're my, you know, they go to my same church, my same synagogue, whatever, I know them, then it feels like this shared, it doesn't just feel like the shared wealth, it becomes the shared wealth.
Yeah.
This kind of community, again, this fabric, right, where you say, these are real people that I know, and they live here, and they reinvest here, and they gave my kid a job, or they gave me a job, or they, what, you know, or whatever, or I started a business and now I sell to them and they're right down the street from me. And we've built this kind of community together, whatever it is. That is, you know,
that camaraderie.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that is like, I don't know, that's precious. And that's,
yeah.
And that is, agree. I think part and parcel to the very heart of this experiment, this country, you know, this democracy. And when we lose that, when we say, I don't know the guy who owns the Walmart, it means nothing to me. I feel nothing to that. And they reciprocate. They think nothing of me either. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's when it all starts to fall apart.
Yeah. Yeah. That excites me. I'm ready for it.
Good.
But it's going to take a lot of time. It's going to take a lot of effort. A lot of work. What would you recommend consumers or business leaders who are listening to this? What would you recommend that they do with this information?
I don't know. Look, I mean, we can all be superheroes. No, we can all be. Yeah. I believe it. We can all be superheroes in our communities, right? We can all do the things that small business associations and others tell us to do, and they're right. We should shop local. We should support our local stores. We should. You know, you should go to your local, you know, town council or city council or county commission meeting, and you should support good policies that try to stop dollar stores from entering communities, or that try to ensure that there are good, small, usable commercial spaces for new businesses to start and their incubators. Support all that kind of stuff. But I think what folks can do if they want to be real superheroes is they can tell their stories, right? There are small business owners all over America who've experienced this kind of discrimination, who have to deal with it day in and day out. They have to deal with being under the thumb of the big guy all the time.
Yeah.
Share those stories, share them publicly, share them with your state AG's office, share them with the Federal Trade Commission, share them with your representative in Congress or in the Senate. Let them know that you're tired of this, that it's unsustainable and that it hurts your community. I mean, I think that's really a good place to start, because when you do that, you can really affect change. You can really let lawmakers and let policymakers know that stuff has to change. The policies have to change. The laws need to be enforced and they need to be strengthened. I don't know. That's it. But be engaged, you know, be good. You know, be good members of your community and get involved how you can.
Yeah, ILSR also has a podcast, right? Similar along that in that vein.
We do indeed. It's called Building Local Power.
It's a great one.
And,
big fan.
Thank you. Yeah, we do. Yeah, we do good work. We have great interviews and great discussions on there. So I would encourage everyone to go to ilsr.org and find building local power, find all kinds of incredible resources for small business, for folks who are interested in policy. It's all there.
Is there anything else you'd like to add before we hop out?
I don't think so. Folks can read the report again. It's called Boxed Out. It is about price discrimination in America and the history of the Robinson-Patman Act and how we can make it better. It's on our site again, ilsr.org. We write in ways that we try to make the writing super, super accessible. It's not like expert level legal jargon. It's just tell the story as best we can in language that everyone can identify with. So I would encourage anyone to go read the report and to get inspired and to try to affect policy out there.
Yeah, I would agree. It helped me understand, you know, the lay of the land, the way the economy has shaped the community around me. I'd say here in West Michigan, Grand Rapids, we have a pretty strong local economy, but it still has, in many ways, has fallen victim to forces, you know, far away from us and have hollowed out our communities around us. But it helped me, you know, understand what's going on. I recommend it.
I promise we can do it. We can change the stuff. We can change policy. We can preserve opportunity and democracy in the economy. We have the power to do it for in places like Grand Rapids, in small towns, and you know, in New York City. We can make it happen.
Yeah. Well, Ron Knox, thank you for jumping on the podcast.
No problem, Manuel. Thank you so much for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the People First Economy podcast. If you're interested in learning more about the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and the work that they're doing to support the growth of local economies, check them out at ilsr.org. There, you can find this Boxed Out report and the great podcast called Building Local Power. That is all for this episode of the People First Economy podcast. So remember, good business matters. And to be a good ancestor.